Hello, folks.
My name is Buzz, and I'm an alcoholic. And tonight's step seven. Last week, I probably sounded like Mickey Mouse because I talked so fast because I came in late. And tonight, I got here in time tonight to go throw up before the meeting, you know, and that's important, you know. As I've said before, I'm not an expert on this. I don't pretend to be. It's not a how-to about the steps. It's what I've learned from working the steps in my life. And this is step seven. Step seven says, we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. I've often heard that step seven is all about humility. The 12 and 12 talks mostly about humility. Last week I quickly counted the word humility, humble, and humiliation 20 times in chapter 7 in the 12 and 12. And I don't want to dispute that step 7 is about humility. The thing is, I personally believe that my addiction set the precedent on how to be humble. I was beat into these rooms. I didn't come here because I wanted to. I believe step 6 is where the pain of the consequences of my behavior did it. Beat me into humility. And last week I talked about the Allies beat the Japanese into humbly surrendering at the end of World War II. They didn't want to surrender. They had to. And I really never wanted to surrender to my alcoholism. And I never really wanted to surrender to any of my character defects. In other words, I really don't have to worry about being humble because my flaws showed me how to be humble. And on, you know, the pain of my flaws, I guess, showed me how to be humble. On page 75 in the 12 and 12, it says, quote, we saw we needn't be blunted or beaten into humility. Now, I think my addiction set the precedent and beat me in here. And once I got to step 6, I started seeing it coming, you know, with the pain that I had addressing my major handicaps, my grosser handicaps, if you will. I had an old mentor named Neil. I've talked about him before. He had many years of sobriety. And one night, early in sobriety, I stopped at his house on the way home from Erie. I was on a stolen motorcycle at the time, and when I was very young in the program, obviously, and I was on just a terrible dry drunk. I mean, one where, boy, I'm taking people's inventory, and, you know, I want to shoot people and throat punch them and everything. I was just miserable. And I stopped because Neil was so mellow. And Neil talked me down. I was about an hour there, and Neil was so calm, and some of you might remember him. He just didn't get shook up, you know, and he didn't say a lot, but he talked me down, and before I left, I asked him, I said a question. I says, Neil, how come you never go on dry drunks? And he said, and I'm paraphrasing this, but it's pretty close. He said, I go on dry drunks just like you. But number one, I catch them quicker than you do. And number two, I know just what to do so I don't let them get as far as you do. And to tell you the truth, you know, after 38 years, I got so I could catch them a little quicker. And I don't let them get as far. And to me, that's recovery. Step 7 says, we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. Now, if you'll allow me, I'm going to get a little sarcastic for a minute. I told you before, I have a motorcycle in a shed that does not run. I did a forced up on it myself, tried to figure out what was wrong. I thought it was a battery. And I put a new battery in it, and it still didn't run. So I guess I had to do a fifth step, and I poked a guy in the program that knows a lot about motorcycles. He came out and he looked at it, did a couple tests, and he says, I think it's your stator, I think is what he called it. And I'm pretty sure I did a fourth and fifth step on this motorcycle, and I know what's wrong with it. And I had a tendency when I got step four and five done, think, okay, I took care of that character defect. But this motorcycle still doesn't run. Now, next spring, when the weather gets nice and I get a nice hot spring day, I'm going to go out in that motorcycle shed and I'm going to get right down on my knees, and as humbly as I can, I'm going to ask, God, would you please remove what's wrong with my motorcycle? And then I'm going to get up, start it, and ride it out of there with no shirt, looking like Ivory Soap. And I'll probably come back like the Red Lobster, right? Because God's going to fix it for me. Sandy Beach, who I hold in very high regard, he also got sarcastic. He says, if step seven worked, we'd have boring discussion meetings, you know. Anybody got a resentment? Fred would say, well, I got this resentment towards my best friend Barney because he ran off with my wife, emptied my bank account, and now, you know, the mortgage is due, I got no money, I'm getting evicted. I had a hell of a resentment, but I asked God to remove it, and he did, so I'm fine. Barney, he'd say, well, I got a resentment because I was walking down the street and Fred just punched me right in the nose. I had a resentment, but I asked God to remove it and he did, and I'm fine. I'm afraid it takes a little more than that. In step seven, we lay a lot on God, humbly asked him to remove it. And God really... I guess I'm done being sarcastic, at least for now, but I hope you see what I'm trying to get at. I'm going to tell another story. You know, we're not a glum lot, you know, but I can see those jokes didn't go over too good. I bombed. I guess I shouldn't quit my day job and become a stand-up comedian, huh? Well, anyway, Sandy Beach, I already got there. Tiger Woods' wife, she didn't ask God to remove it. She got a golf club and smacked him with it and stole all his crap, you know, or sued him for all his stuff. So she had a resentment. Now I'm done being sarcastic, okay? This guy buys a house for taxes, gets it real cheap, and it's falling down. The roof leaks, the windows are busted, the doors are falling off, and he gets it cheap. And the first thing he does is he tears the roof off and puts a new roof on, keep it from leaking. And then the windows, they all need replaced, and they're kind of rotted around. And so he replaces all the windows, and he kind of tightens it up, puts doors on it. He goes inside and tears out all the plaster because it's fallen off from being years of just neglect. And it's fallen down, and he tears off the plaster. The electric is ancient and wouldn't make code, so he tears out all the electric, rewires it. Same with the plumbing, it's all just terrible. Tears that out. He insulates it, puts new sheetrock on, new carpet. In the spring, he moves his family in. And he's there, and one night there's a knock. It's a preacher, invites him in, gives him a cup of coffee, and the preacher says, boy, you and God did a nice job on this house. And he says, God didn't do a very good job by himself, did he? And that sounds kind of sacrilegious, but the point is I'm trying to make, we ask God to remove these defects of character, but God's not going to do it unless we do the footwork. And the step seven, humbly ask God to remove our defects. For me, this is an action step on my part. I have, you know, and the 12 and 12 said, the first sentence is, this is the step that separates the men from the boys, or the girls from the ladies, and so forth. But the problem, I think step seven's more the one that separates, because now I got to do something. And the thing is, I believe it's an action step that needs to be followed up by work. Several years ago, I was having a conversation with a sponsee. I was hoping he'd be here tonight, because I was going to rip on him a little bit, but he's not here. And I said our sobriety was a free gift. He replied, bullshit, it's not free. And after we had a long discussion, we were coming back from a meeting, it was far away, and we came back, and we came to the conclusion that sobriety is a free gift to all alcoholics. Now, I'm going to watch my time, because I got a story here I want to tell. And this is a true story. It's kind of sad. I was in the Villa in Cambridge Springs, and impatience and intolerance, you know, it's not my strong suit. Impatience is one of my grosser handicaps. And there was a guy in the men's room forever, and I was getting real impatient. And we started talking trash through the door. And when he came out, I suckered him with a left hook and a right cross, and he had friends in the bar, and they jumped on me, and I had friends in the bar, they jumped on them, and I never saw so many cops in the little town of Cambridge Springs so fast. And I was in a Villa, and I think this is 40 years later, if I walked in a Villa today to buy a lottery ticket, I think they'd call the cops, but, you know, I was banned from there forever. Well, I was 5 years sober, and I was sponsoring this kid, and we were sitting in the Diamond Deli, and he talked about his brother, and he says, here comes my brother now, you're going to get to meet him. And it was this kid that I sucker punched, and I found out that day I'd broken his jaw rather severely, and I felt so bad I was going to give him a free punch at me, and he didn't take it. He was kind of a gentleman, and believe it or not, I made amends to him, and we kind of became friends. And his brother's name was Danny. Actually, he's deceased also, but Danny and I took his brother to a few meetings. We kind of 12-stepped him. And he says, well, I'm glad that my brother's sober and you're helping him, and I'm really glad you're sober. And he went out. Well, one night, he was drinking. He had a BAC of 2.6, which is pretty high. And it was out towards his parents' house, and he was laying on the road going up Kenner Hill, or maybe it was, yeah, Kenner Hill. And a car ran him over, rolled him up underneath the pumpkin. Marilyn told me not to tell any details, but anyway, he died. And I felt horrible. And after his funeral, I went up to see Neil, because Neil was not my sponsor. He was just my go-to guy, because he didn't say much, but what he did say meant a lot. And I said, how come I got chosen to get sober and he didn't? And he said, he had the same choice you did. And I believe, you know, and the big book and the chapter to the agnostic, they say the road, it's the pathway. God is not hard on those that seek him. The road is open to all. And I believe all alcoholics, sooner or later, get the chance to stay sober. I got the chance many times. My first sponsor told me this story about the guy that was in a flood above his house, and he gets up on the roof and he's praying to God to save them. And pretty soon a rowboat comes along and he sees other people on the houses, and he said, save them first, I'm okay, I got an arrangement with God. Father Martin tells this story too. And they go on, and he keeps praying, and another rowboat comes along, and he says, save these other people. And he keeps praying. The helicopter drops a line down to him, and he motions over. There's a woman with a baby over on a roof, and he motioned him over. Well, it keeps raining, and he drowns. And he goes up, and he says to God, didn't you hear me praying? And God says, yeah. And he says, how come you didn't save me? And God says, geez, I sent you two rowboats and a helicopter. What more do you want, you know? And the thing is, God sent me. I got sober many times and threw it away, just like my friend that I was talking about. He got the thing and he threw it away. So, and I was talking to my sponsee, and I really think sobriety is a free gift. But I also think my sponsee was right. You have to work. You have to work to stay sober. That's what you all are doing here right now by coming here listening to me. Hopefully, you don't go to the bar as soon as you get out of here tonight. I don't think I'm going to, but you know, I hope you stay sober. Because it takes a lot of work. And I believe step seven is only in part about humility, but for the most part, I believe step seven is more about work. I had to work for the change, and it wasn't easy. I had to work at changing, and I have to work to keep the change, and I still work at keeping the change. If I stop working, I revert to my core behavior. Just as last week I talked about Ricky Ricardo, for you people that weren't here last week, his core language is Spanish, and he was in a sitcom and he spoke very fluent English until he got stressed and upset, which usually was something Lucy did, and he would revert to speaking Spanish. Well, when I get stressed, I revert and I stop working. My default mode is I get drunk. So I can't revert too long before I get drunk. My character defects, my grosser handicaps are I'm controlling, I'm impatient, and I'm defiant. And that comes back. Actually, my bride's here, and she'll tell you, when I'm not feeling good or something, they start coming out. When they start coming out, I got to work to put them back in the box, because they never go away. My alcoholism never went away. I'm still an alcoholic, but see, I manage it. Even though I don't drink, that's because I manage it. And then I try. It's really hard for me not to be controlling. It really is. I work at that constantly, and when I go on the least little bit of dry drunk, I come right back in where I take control. And I talked in step one about my life was unmanageable. When I get stressed, I try to take it back and try to manage my life. And I've been sober a long time. Every time I've ever gotten in trouble in my sobriety, I was managing my life. So anyway, my behavior, my grosser handicaps are controlling, impatient, and rebellious or defiant. As I said last week, these defects forced me into surrendering. Now, I surrendered a little quicker with my defects of character than I did with my alcoholism. But I think my addiction, one of the things, everybody sitting here, for whether it's Vince or Asa, that's just new here, I take it, to somebody that's been here forever. It's the thing is, we have a precedent on all the steps, really, set by our addiction. Because we had to do the work to get sober. and stay sober. The sobriety was a gift. I got it many times. Right off the bat, the first time I drank, I puked up the next day. I thought I was... I got the dry heaves, and Bill Cosby used to do a skit. He says, you get the dry heaves, and you're not going to be surprised if you see your shoes come out, you know. And I went out into the kitchen where my mom and dad was, and I said, I'll never drink again. I wasn't lying. I meant it. I changed my mind, but I meant it at the time. Now, what kind of work do we have to do to stay happy, joyous, and free, and work on these character defects that we have? I'm going to refer to what Joe McHugh says in his book, The Steps We Took, page 95. There's two paragraphs, and this is a direct quote from... I'm not paraphrasing this unless my... bride missed. Okay, good. She typed it word for word for me. Anyway, Joe says, I always like to use the illustration how to lose weight when we talk about the principle of change. If you want to change the body, you use the same principle as you use to change your mind. The body is the result of the food we put into it. What's in our minds are the result of the thoughts we have put into them. From the very first thought we had until today. If we want to change the body, we have to change the food we put in it. If you want to lose some weight, you have to stop eating the food you really like. Maybe it's candy or fast food, milkshakes, french fries, and all that stuff. Those things are objectionable. Why? You looked in the mirror and saw yourself. You saw how you looked, and you saw the results of eating those foods. You have to stop doing what you're doing and do what you don't want to do. Now, I mean, when I came here the first time, and the first time I said I'm buzzed and I'm an alcoholic, I was beat here. I did not want to come here. I did not like being in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I was real ultra uncomfortable, you know. Saying I was an alcoholic in front of a bunch of people was like trying to swallow a big dry horse turd, you know. And the thing is, where I was comfortable in bars that I wouldn't even go into in the daytime now, and I would frequent them at night. I was in a bar in Cambridge one time when a guy come in and shot his wife with a .30-06, you know, and that was kind of abnormal even for that bar. I mean, that bar, you could tell people from out of town because the men's room, anybody that was local would just kick the door and pee in, you know. If a guy went in there, they were from out of town. It had a toilet seat on a nail in the wall, you know, but, you know, Lee's laughing because he might have drank a few times in there. But anyway, I had to change that. I had to give up going to the bars, hanging out with my buddies that drink. I went to my 5-year high school class reunion. I got so drunk I don't remember leaving. I went to my 10-year class reunion, and I got so drunk I don't remember leaving. And I quit drinking. I haven't been to a class reunion since. Now, I have a dear friend from high school that became a cop. Actually, he was the chief of police in Meadville for several years, 34 years. And he says, why don't you go to the class reunion with me? I says, I'm not going to go to a place where all the people I drank with are going to be drinking, you know. I don't want to be around it. And he says, I won't let you drink. And I says, buddy, you better bring your gun, your badge, your handcuffs, your taser wouldn't hurt, you know, because if you're going to keep me from drinking, probably it still ain't going to work unless you shoot me, you know, because if I want to drink, I'm going to drink. And I had to change that because I went to a Super Bowl Sunday party for years, and a lot of times I had to get the paper the next day to find out who won, you know. But we called it a game dinner. We'd eat a squirrel or a duck or something and drink a whole lot of beer, you know, and whiskey. And then, you know, probably be idiots. I quit getting invited to those, and I don't go to the Super Bowl Sunday parties with them anymore. And I gave up a lot of things because I had to change, just like changing to lose weight. And I know every person in this room that's looking at me had to do that because we were comfortable with our addiction no matter how bad it was. So if you want to change your... that's how you change. Now, I changed all that and lived happily ever after, right? No, that's a fairy tale. That's not real life, and this is real life. And I'm happy, but Marilyn, would you pass those out now? Marilyn's got a handout that I think it's very simple, but it's important. And what it says basically is what you feed grows and what you starve dies. Now, I told you about what it was like 38 years ago when I came into the rooms. I can remember the first AA dance I went to. I'm dope sick and I'm withdrawn from alcohol, and I'm hanging on to myself to keep from jumping out of my skin. And there was this old rickety guy that had been sober about 100 years named Wilbur P. He gets up to the microphone and he's all feeble, and he gets up there and he goes, "Ain't it great to be sober?" And I'm there like, "Hell no, sober's the last thing in the world I want to be. I want to be dead ass drunk, but I can't, you know." And I was, today, it's really great to be sober. And those bars, I don't go to bars. Last time I was around drinking, I think, was 2 or 3 years ago on the 1st of October, where my family still drinks, and I have a niece that got married at the VFW. And I went there with my wife, my two daughters, and I sat with my sister and brother-in-law, and she has Alzheimer's and he doesn't drink because he's diabetic. And we went there and we ate, and then I got a drink that was coffee, but it was in a glass. And I walked around and I talked to people for a few minutes just to make an appearance, and then I left. We kind of snuck out of there and nobody missed us. We left. And I tell you what, Neil would have said I was as nervous as a fart in a hot skillet. You know, he used to say that. I don't know what it would be like, but I was nervous, okay? And right now, I'm sure there's a bar within 5 minutes of here. This is eerie. I could find one probably walking within 5 minutes. I'd be very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable. And I'm comfortable here. I was a little nervous tonight. I was a lot better after I went to the restroom and puked it because, you know, I was going to talk up here, but no, I didn't. I don't live happily ever after. Because one of the things, and it talks about this in the big book, I rest on my laurels. Things get pretty good, and I get comfortable. And I'll talk about this in the 10th step. What it is I'm not doing a good 10th step. I'm not diligent about the work, and I just kind of rest. And then pretty soon, the pain of my defects subside. And I think this is natural. Pain subsides. I 2 years ago, I took two guys to a meeting in Titusville, and between the two of them, they put together, they had 30 days together, sobriety. And one was coming off a really wicked heroin addiction, and the other one was coming off an extremely wicked alcohol addiction. And they're talking all the way down there about panic attacks, anxiety attacks. They're wondering if they're going to have a seizure. I'm wondering if they're going to have a seizure. On the way back, I'm that hot skillet thing again. I'm like that. I mean, I couldn't sleep that night because it took me right back there, and it reminded me of that pain. And you know, one of the things, the reasons I go to meetings is there's new people at the meetings, and I can feel you. This is not your best day. Right now your life sucks, because you know why? That's what every one of us in here went through. That it wasn't great. I didn't think I could stay sober. I was going, I almost assaulted the doctor on my first day sober, and he gave me a shot of Valium to calm me down. He gave me 25 milligrams, you know, right in the shoulder. Of course, I almost assaulted him and scared him, and I was just hoping for 10, you know. But anyway, I'm back to being sarcastic again, aren't I? We're not a glum lot. But anyway, the pain of my defects subside. I have an ego, and my arrogance raises its ugly head. I take control, and I start to manage my own life again. And I told you, I had the illusion when I was drinking and drugging that I could manage my own life, and I can't. And I've been sober 38 years. The bad news is I still can't manage my own life. The good news is I've never had to, because I have the example and the advice. When I hear sirens, it's still kind of, you know, the hair kind of goes up on my neck, you know. But anyway, I start to manage my own life, and guess what? That pain returns. We have a question and answer here in a couple minutes, and this young lady early on in the program sat back there, and she says, I was talking about getting back to basics. How do you know when to get back to basics? It's real easy. When the pain reminds me, the pain of doing whatever I'm doing. And a lot of times, the pain is I'm not getting along with my bride, you know. And I have to take that inventory, and usually I have to let go of my controlling and my impatience. And so we were late last week because of the snow. There was people. It wasn't because of the snow. It was because of people in front of me driving 35 miles an hour. And we were talking before, you know. Jack said, I'll bet you were mumbling under your breath. No, I had to win. I was taking their inventory, you know. One time there was a lady in front of me, an older lady in front of me, in line when I was in a hurry. And she had a whole bunch of items in the 20 items or less. And I wanted to go up and give her a forearm shiver in the back of the head. But that's kind of not appropriate, hitting some old lady, because she's delaying you a little bit, you know. I was probably on a dry drunk, you know. Anyway, it gets back to the pain and the control. It repeats for as long as I've been in recovery. That repeats over and over again. Now, I'm going to go back and tell you another Neil story, because I got time and I'm going to quickly end. First, though, do you remember the sitcom Fred Sanford? Yeah, he was a junk dealer. He's this old black man with a whiskey, gravelly voice. And he had a son named Lamont that was kind of a good kid, you know. And Fred says, Lamont, I wish I knew where I was going to die. And Lamont says, why is that, Pop? He says, I'd never go there. Well, see, that's for me the principle that I know where I'm going to get drunk. I know where I'm going to get controlling. I know situations to stay out of. I don't go there. I stopped at Neil's house on the way home from Erie. Did I read this already? Okay. I stopped at Neil's house, the old mentor, on the way home from Erie. I was riding a stolen motorcycle. I was very young in the program. And on a terrible dry drunk. Oh, boy. It was a situation over a lady that I kind of had some problems with. I had problems with ladies sometimes because I guess it was my defects is the reason, but mostly anyway. And I stopped because Neil was so mellow, and I was like, well, Neil talked me down before I left, and I said, he was sober 30-some years when he died. He was a terrible driver, even though he got run over by a truck. And now when he pulled out in front of him, this is how he died. And he was sober 32 years. But anyway, I said, before I left, I said, Neil, how come you don't go on dry drunks? He says, I go on dry drunks just like you. He says, but the thing is, number one, I catch them a lot quicker. And number two, I know just what to do so I don't let them get that far. And that is practicing the principles. That's why I need to have a sponsor. I need to have sponsees. I'm very fortunate because my bride is also in a program. And that helps me. And the thing is, if I stop working and doing these things, I'm going to revert back, and pretty soon, and I'm just going to start managing my life, and it's going to get painful. And if the pain gets bad enough, I know what I do because I've seen me do it before. I go to the bar and I get a drink. Even though I know what that's going to do, the drink offers me the whew. You know that feeling you get when you're down a double shot of Southern Comfort? That's what will lure me back. That's all I got, folks, but this is a question time. Jerome has a question there.
Make sure we're working.
Okay. Thanks, boss. I wasn't here last week, so I don't know if you covered this.
It's on.
But there's
a CD, but I guess Kevin isn't here. It'll be. No, you got some. There's some CDs.
Okay,
there.
But when you talk about these character defects, do you take make an inventory of these character defects somewhere so you know what you're looking for?
Absolutely. They're what Bill Wilson called the grosser handicaps, and Joe McHugh also addresses it in the steps we took with Joe McHugh. Everybody has them. They're like core issues. I went into detail last week a lot.
Okay, so I missed that part.
Yeah, and the thing is, I got a couple sponsees here. Do you guys have your grocer handicaps in your wallet on the credit card thing? There you go. He does. Joe, we need to talk. Okay. Danny's getting them out, you know. I put them on a card and give them to my sponsees, and I got them on a card in my wallet. I have them down here. I have, there's only four major ones. I'm impatient, I'm controlling, I'm defiant, and a secondary one is because of those three, I'm also very inconsiderate. And those are the ones that show up most often when I do a four-step. I mean, I have a whole shitload of other character defects, too. I'm not telling you. Believe me, I'm not going to be... You know, when it says we're not saints, they were talking about me. I'm definitely not a saint.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jerome. Thanks for the question. We got another one here. Okay, Bruce.
Bruce, alcoholic. Thanks, hey, Bruce. Buzz. That was a good
message about step seven.
Thank you, Bruce.
I'm sitting here thinking of a good question. You know, in my program, you know, I can go to a conference and be there all week and, you know, be like a hilltop, mountaintop experience. And, you know, everything is just fantastic. I'd like to stay there, but you have to come back to the real world and it tears down. And I thought about you. How did this step help you in your journey through the Appalachian Trail?
Well, there's peaks and valleys in the Appalachian Trail, and I still had to work. You know, I didn't go to meetings. I was on the Appalachian Trail for 6 months. It's 2,200 miles long, and I didn't go to meetings. Only once, twice. I went to meetings two times in that 6 months, but I had to work the program constantly. It was in 2006, and they had roaming charges, and I had $300 phone bills, and Marilyn was paying my bills for. I left her an account where she could pay my bills, and the first $300 phone bill I had, she says, "You need to cut back." And I called a guy in the program, and he says, "Well, let's talk about that. It's $300. That's a lot for a phone bill, but that's how you work your program." He says, "You're in Tennessee. If you get drunk there, you don't want to be in a Tennessee jail, because if you open your mouth, they're going to know you're a Yank." And believe it or not, in Tennessee, there's some guys that's still pissed off about the war, you know. And then, how much would it cost you to get out of that jail? It would ruin your hike. There's other things that are probably more pricey than $300 phone bills, like fines, cost, restitution, you know, and all that good stuff. And, you know, after that, I talked to my bride, and I spent whatever it took on the phone, because my program is worth more. I mean, I don't know if it's worth more to me than 300. If I go out, it doesn't take me long to blow through $300, I'm sure. And that was 40 years ago. Today, God. I mean, I was paying 35 cents for a long neck beer. I don't know what they cost. You know, $4.50 for a case. Yeah. It's kind of, I don't know what a six-pack costs today, but it's more than I want to pay, you know. I can remember when somebody said it's a buck for a draft, and I said, "What the hell?" It's probably cheap by today's standards. I don't know. That kind of answers your question. And the thing is, you know, this is not a fairy tale. I'm not at that mountaintop. You know, I have bad days. I get sick. I get restless, irritable, and discontent. But the thing is, I don't stay there, because I have you folks that, you know, I go to a meeting, and I think the most valuable thing I can give anybody else, and the most valuable thing I ever got from a meeting, and I got it right from the very first meeting, is I got hope that I can do this. I got hope because I have tangible people. Right now, I've got 20-some people, clear-eyed, sober, looking me in the eye. You're all doing what I'm trying to do, and that's part of it. And you can get that kind of hope in the literature. You can get it on the phone. Nowadays, there was no internet when I was on the trail in 2006. There was, but I didn't have it. You can get on the internet now, and it's that spiritual connection, you know. Ace and I, we have the same story. Different details, but we have the same story. You don't know that yet, but you will. Because we all have the same. Jerome, the guy next to you, is laughing. He's been around here forever. And he knows we're all the same. We're brothers and sisters here. Another question.
Anybody else?
All right. Thank you.
I can what?
Okay.